Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Off the Shelf for Saturday, March the 20th, 2010. I'm your host, Denise Turner, coming to you live from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I am always so thankful for your support, and I encourage you to not let another day pass before you pick up a copy of Long Walk Up. Long Walk Up is a powerfully moving, inspirational book that you need to add to your book collection. You can pick up a copy of Long Walk Up today by visiting www.chistell.com. And you can also pick up a copy of Long Walk Up from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walmart, and other bookstores. If you don't see it on the shelf, just ask the clerk for it because it's carried by the largest book distributors in the world. And now on this blessed day, and it is absolutely gorgeous here in Philadelphia, I'm honored to bring to you an upwardly mobile author who hails from the Windy City, although he now told me he lives in Texas, but he is originally from Chicago, Illinois. Today's off-the-shelf special guest is none other than the talented and gifted John Williams. John Williams is the author of the books Daddy and Me, Sell, which is City Folk Electronically Living Life, The Secrets We Hide in Our Cell Phones, What Could Have Been, The Saint, The Sinner, and The Attempt, and The Reunion. John is also the host of the literary radio program Creative Soul. Please visit John Williams online at www.thearthur.us. Again, that's www.thearthur.us. The author, spelled exactly how it sounds, .us. Welcome to Off the Shelf, John. Finally, we connected.
It's been a long time coming.
Oh,
I'm really, really excited about it, man. I appreciate you taking time out, just having me on the show, man, so we can politic and talk and just get down to business with it.
Oh, I'm so happy. I have to tell our listeners here at Off the Shelf, I was scheduled to be on John's show, the Creative Soul radio show, and I slipped up on that one, so I apologize to John publicly. And I'm just grateful for his graciousness, which all of our listeners can see with him being here this morning, his graciousness in coming on Off the Shelf here today. So I truly thank him for that. You're from a town that my book, Portia, my first book that was published, takes place in, which is Chicago. And
it takes
place on the south side of Chicago, and that's where you are from. As I was doing the research for the interview, and Chicago is the same area for our listeners that I just love her, the renowned and so loved poet Gwendolyn Brooks lived in for years.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a handwritten note from her hanging in on my living room wall. She was just, people who met her said she was like meeting your grandmother. She was just a wonderful, wonderful person. And she included Chicago in her writings. That said, John, I wanted to ask you, how has growing up and living in Chicago impacted you as a writer?
Well, you know, Chicago is going to basically give you whatever you ask for it and a little bit more. You know, it can be an ugly, pretty, nice, mean, wonderful, terrible town, you know, and you get that all wrapped up in one. It's like a gumbo, too, because you have the neighborhoods that really allow people of all nationalities, every color, shape, creed, to get, you know, even sexual preference, to get together and share ideas and time. So, you know, being a product of the south side of Chicago, single-parent home, you know, I use the city to develop a really deep appreciation for the arts, for people, poetry, music, writing. And then, you know, when I was younger, I was exposed to so much, man. I always say, like, the bittersweet parts of life. Those same streets that I'm from consumed my father before I was even born. You know, he was murdered and gunned down in the street 6 months before I was going to be born. And it's the same city that embraced me as its own son, you know, through programs, the educational system, and then just being able to politic and talk with so many other like-minded individuals. Man, it really molded me. And anybody that knows me, they know in a heartbeat, if somebody says something about Chicago, I'll hop right up out of my seat. Matter of fact, I'm going to demonstrate. I'll hop out of my seat. It really has helped shape who I am.
Oh, you love it. You love Chicago. Okay. I wanted to ask you, how old were you when you realized that you were a writer, that you said the city had a lot of impact on you, and you definitely experienced a life events that would definitely shape a person and change them forever. But how old were you when you realized that you were a writer, and was there a particular event? I'm always interested when writers answer this question. Was there a particular event that caused you to know that you were a writer?
Well, there were two things that I could isolate immediately. First, I had to be about, let's see, how old are kids when they're in fourth grade? I don't know, maybe like 8 or 9 or 10.
Okay.
We had a gifted program. You know, I was in a school that, I mean, basically it was a daycare center. You know, nothing against them, no diss, but people took their kids there because they had to go to work. And learning came secondhand to surviving and just being able to walk down the street and make it home without getting hit by a bullet or in a fight or robbed. So it was a gifted program, and they had a teacher who specialized in creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
She used to talk with me. Big old woman, man. You know, she was an Italian, big old woman, and she was just had a big old heart. And she used to tell me, you know, I want you to write. And I would say, hey, I don't have any pens and paper at home. She would bring me a notebook and give me a pack of pencils, and she would challenge me to write about the things that I cared about. And you know, while other kids were talking about the newest toy or the newest video game, I was writing some pretty compelling stories about, you know, having hard times and why I still wake up and smile. Yeah, so it was maybe like around that fourth grade, 8, 9, 10 years old that I realized I can do it. But it was more informal. When I got older, it was a unique event that actually that made me want to do this for real. And it was a dare. Can you believe that? I have a very close-knit group of friends. We've known each other since we were kids. Went through high school together and, you know, had a lot of the same classes. And so each year we tried to get together and do a guys trip. You know, we would pick a city, get together, you know, tell our wives, girlfriends, significant others that they had to stay home, and we would go have fun, you know, let our hair down.
Okay.
Even though I don't have no hair, you know, I'm bald head, but we would let our hair down. And figure of speech, y'all. I know people are out there laughing. But basically, we went to Vegas. And Las Vegas is a very exciting town. It's America's playground, I think they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the very last day, we just sat and talked about what our plans were for the next few years of our lives. And, you know, we celebrated the stuff that we were able to do. And then we challenged each other to do something that we've never done before, to get something that we never had before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would tell somebody, hey, man, you need to be married. You know, you need to get out these streets, stop womanizing. You know, I would tell somebody that, and then somebody would tell another person, well, you need to get a real job, man. You ain't had a career in years. You know, you like Tommy off Martin. Get you a real job with some benefit. And then when it got around to me, they were like, John, man, you know, we need you to chase after some of these dreams. He said, you were the class clown in high school, man. You got all these stories and these things. You need to put some of it on paper, but I think you're scared. And, you know, I'm a 6 foot, 220-pound man, and I don't like nobody telling me I'm scared. So I said, what you mean? He said, well, I don't think you got what it takes to put it in the book, man, you know. And that's how it all started, off of a dare on the guy's trip in Vegas.
Oh, my goodness. It reminds me of, I can't think of the title of the book, but the three doctors who grew up together, and they made a pact, They made a pact that they would always encourage each other to do positive things. And that's interesting to hear another man yourself say that men get together and either to hang out to have fun, but to encourage each other to do the best that they can. I think that's just fabulous. And that's interesting. That's the way you got started writing. What were your earliest writings, John? Did you start writing poetry, songs, novels, short stories?
You know, I tried to develop a unique style. I focused mainly on, you know, a journal. I had a journal where I would highlight some of my shortcomings and things that made me afraid, things that I did that I didn't want my mother to find out about, you know, that I had to, you know, that I wanted to revel in and go back and look at, or things that I dreamed to do or wanted to do but just never could. So it started out like that. I dabbled in poetry, but it was too restrictive in the sense that I couldn't paint a picture, and I wanted people to be able to see the same story that I did. You know, I wanted people to see that unbelievable story, you know, if I could write it in a believable way. I wanted them to, you know, like, wow, you know. And so I started out with the journals, and then I started picking up some of the, you know, the urban classics, you know, things mm-hmm. like The Coldest Winter Ever and some of Zane's stuff, Air Jerome, Dickey, Dr. Maya Angelou. I picked up a lot of those and read those and a lot of poetry and, you know, book fairs and libraries. Mm-hmm. I hit those up. And then, you know, a lot of this stuff influenced me, and so I started to write little short stories, and that's really how I began to explore the writing seriously.
Now, when you were like about 9 years old, you had a teacher who was working with you at a school or program that you were at, and she supported, you know, your creative abilities, your creative side. And then after that, you had this dare with your friends as you were a grown man. That's when you decided to go after writing. It sounds like you went straight after that with a clear focus. Had you had any experience or any knowledge of the book industry prior to that, taking on that dare? Any experience about the book industry? Any experience or knowledge about how to actually write a story? Or did you just say, you know what, I'm gonna. They dare me, I'm going to take it up, and you just got a clear focus, and you went straight after it.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I didn't have any kind of professional training. I never worked for a newspaper. I wasn't an editor. I hadn't put anything out. I didn't even write for, you know, little columns. I haven't even done anything like that. But, you know, I went into it. I'm an extremely driven man. Anybody knows me, they know that if I say I'm going to do something, hell or high water, I'm going to get it done. And if I can't, I won't say I'll do it. You know, if I tell you that I'm going to the moon, y'all better get y'all cameras out and tell me to take some pictures of the Milky Way because I'm going to bring them back to you. But if it's something that I know that I have a challenge with, I won't make a commitment to you. Those are really important things in my life. And then what's worse than breaking a promise you make to yourself, you know? So it's mm-hmm. like once I said I would do it, I did have to research and I did read a lot and go to the library and talk to people who I admired, one in particular was an author. Her name is Candace Dow. She wrote Caught in the Mix, a number of other urban novels. And I reached out to her, sent her an email, and just said, yo, I'm a good black dude. I ain't in no priors. I don't got no warrants. You know, I ain't got no child support, dude. You know, could you please just take me under your wing, help me understand what I need to do? And she and I went back and forth writing letters and emails, and then you know, through her and through just going out myself and learning libraries and stuff, I figured out the right process and the right formula, you know, style, how to write the book. Then I looked at how to get it bound, how to get it print, then how to market, all that stuff I picked up on my own.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of those things like the marketing and how actually to structure a book as we go further into the interview. Now, I want to get to your first book that you published. And your writing, I noticed as I was doing the research, it kind of stretches across a wide breadth. Your first book is a children's coloring book, and it's titled Daddy and Me. And I want to ask you, why did you decide to start your author publishing career with a children's book?
You know, I get asked this a whole lot. When they hear I have a children's book, some people laugh, and then I look at them, and then they stop laughing. They're like, okay, I'm gonna stop laughing at him. He look like he's tough. But it was more for my soul. You know, I wanted to do something to kind of close a chapter in my life. My father was killed when he was 19. Mm-hmm. When I had my first son, I was 19 going on 20. So I didn't want my life to mirror the fate of his. And when I had my son and I got past 19, I felt like it was time to celebrate, you know, because for a long time I thought I was going to share the same fate.
Okay.
I had my son, and it was one of the most amazing, beautiful experiences. You know, I always wanted to be a good dad. I just wanted to be there for him. If we were going to be broke, we were going to be broke together. If we were going to eat beans, we were going to eat beans together. You know, if we had money and we could do things, we would do it together. So we have a very strong bond. He looked just like me, and it's hard not to like him. So
right.
The first book I wanted to put out to kind of share about the bond that father and son can have, you know, and show the world that it's black men out there that's not all negative and that we do, you know, you still can be a male, a hetero male, and be tough and all of these things and strong, but you can still love your son. And so I put Daddy and Me out. I made it. It was a summer project for my son Because, you know, every summer I ask him, what do you want to do? Sometimes he'll say, you know, I want to make a lemonade stand. Or sometimes I want to, you know, I want to build a doghouse. And then, you know, at that particular time, he said, I want to make a book. And it came right in line with what I was trying to do anyway. So we got together. I asked him what he wanted it to be about. He said, let's make it about us. And then the rest is his.
That's so sweet. How has Daddy and Me enriched the lives of the people who've read the book? And what type of comments do you get from children, parents, caregivers, teachers about Daddy and Me?
You know, Daddy and Me, I think to date, has sold the most copies out of all the books I wrote. It's a really cute book. It's interactive, and I think that's what is the big kicker. I'm in my library now, and I'm walking to the shelf, and I'm picking up a copy. You know, it's this bright yellow book. You cannot miss it. The pictures and all the illustrations were done by me personally. I actually picked up a pen and called myself drawing pictures, and they came out well, you know. And my son actually colored them. But I think what makes it so, you know, like the appeal is so strong is it's very basic. So kids, when they see it, they pick up crayons and they immediately start coloring because it's more than just a short story. It's actually the first coloring book put out from an African-American author about this particular topic. So
wow.
It's interactive. You pick the book up, you don't see any of the DC Comics characters or Spider-Man or anybody. You see a black man and a black kid, you know, sharing time together. And so that's why the kids like it. The parents like it because it's a great talk piece between them, just talking about fathers. I've had people who were in my same situation. You know, they lost their dad to the streets. Some of them were incarcerated. And then other times, it's a great tool for guys. You know, a lot of men who maybe have custody situations, they'll buy the book, and they'll spend the afternoon with some burgers and fries and will sit and color the book with their son. And it's time because every book is going to be different based on how you color and illustrate it. So I think it's a special piece.
Well, how old was your son when you two created this book together? How old was he?
That was in 2004. So he is 10 now. He was what, 5? I think he was 5.
Oh, he was a little boy. Okay,
yeah.
He was a little boy. Do you plan on writing any more children's books, John?
I think I do want to. I want to do one that has to do with daughters and little girls, because there's a lot of little girls that. Especially in my family, I got a house full of women, you know, as far as my aunties and all of them. But I think it's good to have something for the girls as well, because they actually like it more than the little boys do, you know, coloring and trinkets. I think I'm going to, you know, center it around there, but I think that'll be later on in my career.
Okay. And you also co-authored your second book, Cell. What was it like co-authoring a book? What was that process like for you?
It was kind of difficult because we were in two different cities. He was still back in Chicago, and I was in Texas. But, you know, technology is something else. And so we thought about it. This is actually the same guy who dared me to do it in Vegas. And so I was like, well, since you dared me to do it, I bet you won't do it with me. How about that? You know? And so we laid down the foundation, and it all started from an idea, but we went literally back and forth. I would say, I'm going to take this chapter, you take this chapter, you take this chapter, and then we merged it all and wrote the entire book via email. So I thought that was cool.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. How long did that take?
This book actually only took about 3 months because
wow.
We had so many ideas, and it was such an easy topic. I mean, the secrets we hide in our cell phones, that's just crazy in itself. We all immediately, you got listeners right now that's probably taking their phone out, deleting phone numbers and text messages, and, you know, they're like, oh, my God, I better take this picture out. But, I mean, we had a whole lot in our cell phones. And we can walk out the house, and we'll forget our lip gloss or you know, our keys, and it's like, oh, okay, it's all right, I'll leave them. I don't need that key, know it. You leave your cell phone, you freak out. You're like, oh, my God, I left my cell phone. I take my code off of it, too. Oh, my God, I got to go back. I got to turn back.
So,
you know what I'm saying? That's why you laugh.
Actually, I'm not that attached to my cell phone. I got to be honest with you. I know a lot of people who do. They can't go without their BlackBerry. I don't have a BlackBerry, but I don't use my cell phone a whole lot. But I wonder, the title is very intriguing. And again, for our off-the-shelf listeners, it's Cell. It stands for City Folk Electronically Living Life, The Secrets We Hide in Our Cell Phones. And that title is very intriguing, as I'm sure our off-the-shelf listeners would agree. What tell us about some of the things that you do discuss in the book, Sal.
Well, I mean, it's a very strong storyline. It's about three best friends who live, they work, and they play in Chicago. And then, you know, they all are in a different stage of development in the relationship. You know, you got one guy who's married and he's having a few problems. You got one guy who's thinking about getting married, so he's at a crossroads in terms of, you know, does he take the step with this woman? And then you got one guy who ain't getting married at all. He's a player. He don't want to get married to nobody. And so all three of them are best friends, and they kind of aid and assist each other with, you know, the problems. You know, you got a player and somebody who's thinking about getting married trying to give a man who might want to get a divorce advice. And so that's funny right there. And then you got somebody that's been married that might get divorced, and another guy who was excited trying to give a player advice about, you know, about relationships.
Yeah.
So through those experiences, they have some unique things happen, and then they expose like some tips about how to find out, you know, about the world of wireless treachery, as we call it.
What made you decide to take on this subject? I haven't heard of another book yet. Maybe I haven't have forgotten that takes it kind of spins around what happens when people use cell phones or leave messages in cell phones, and the, you know, people when they suspect that their boyfriend or girlfriend, is your husband or wife, is cheating. That's one of the first places they go, either to the internet and see what they've been doing on the internet, or let me check out their cell phone. What made you decide to take on this subject?
Well, what was funny about it is we wanted to write something that had a drama, because we thought that the winning formula for books is just make drama, you know, and they'll buy it. And then, you know, we did a lot of interviews. We actually had an open call on Craigslist and MySpace at the time, saying, hey, you know, tell us about sometimes people use their cell phone, you know, and deceived you, or tell me time. And then, like, the stuff we would get back, I mean, you would think people would have a little bit of tactfulness or be a little discreet. I mean, they were telling everything. They were, oh, this man, his ass done did this, and I found him, and he had pictures with his you on, sticking it in, so-and-so. It just, yeah, it went kind of berserk. But every time they responded, it always had something to do with them going through a phone or getting a text message or checking a voicemail on the phone. And so we were like, that's got to be it. We have to focus in on that. And that's really how it started.
Wow, wow. From blog posts to posting pictures on social sites like Facebook, MySpace, I mean, you could go on and on. People are seem to be opening up their lives more and more to each other, and they may not realize that they're doing that. It's not like you put something on Facebook and you think only your friends will see it or only certain people. You don't really know maybe who all seen the stuff that's on the internet or even what you put on a website. And so we seem to be opening up and even letting strangers see some details of our lives, that if we met these people next door, we don't even have that – we don't reveal that much even to our neighbor who we've lived next door to for years.
You hit an interesting point. I mean, the case of these young girls who are getting ostracized in high school because they have sent their boyfriend some pictures of their body, you know, their nipples or their – you know. And it's funny because those same girls, if asked face-to-face – if the boy said, hey, you know, let me check out your knockers, they'd be like, oh, no, that's crazy. But they'll go in the bathroom, take their phone, and be posing in the mirror and then send that like it's not the same. So
yeah.
I think this is a hot topic. We were on to something way back then, and, you know, we just tried to tap into it a little bit. I think this rabbit hole goes real deep.
Why do you think, I'm just curious, why do you think people feel more comfortable do you think people they feel like, well, they really don't know who I am, they don't know where I live, so they feel more comfortable putting, I mean, extremely private things out on the internet for the whole world to see, but yet if they their neighbor asks them a question like that,
yeah,
they'd be like offended.
Yeah, they get upset.
Why do you think that is?
I think it has to do with America and the world, for that matter, has gained an overwhelming comfort level with not being social. They call them social networks, but that's not being social. You know, you grew up like probably I did. Social was this. It was a basement fish fry with Big Mama and them, and so a deck of cards. Somebody had some pop, so some Pepsi or Royal Crown Cola, and some the men usually brought beer in, and it was a bunch of people talking and laughing and dancing.
Yeah.
Marvin Gaye records on. That's what socializing is. That's what being social is. But they call them social networks now, and you're not being social. Think about it. You're sitting at a computer,
right?
Sitting down for 80% of your day. And you're not talking to anybody. You typing on the computer. So I just thought that was interesting.
That is interesting that you said. And they do call them social networks. But I agree with you. You're not being social. You're not even talking to anybody face to face. You're not having any. You're just having one form of contact, and it's not. You don't have any body language.
I can't see your face.
None of that. So that is interesting, but people are doing it more and more. That said, and before we go to talk about another one of your books, what impact, John, do you see these networks and technology, cell phones, the computers, the Blackberries, where some people are literally just almost like addicted to those things? What impact do you see them having on human relationships across all levels, parents and children, couples, friends, 10 to 20 years from now?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's a double-edged sword. You know, in one hand, we've never been able to access information, exchange ideas this quickly. You know, if we wanted to call somebody, we used to have to pick a phone up and do. Now, when the last time you memorized somebody's phone number? You know what I mean? Now we just go find a name and hit the button. So in one hand, we can access information quicker, but in another hand, we've lost the beauty in enjoying the simple pleasures of life, like opening a letter and reading and knowing that somebody put their hand on this page just like you and used ink and write these words, and, you know, with all its flaws and all of its mistakes. I think that, you know, it's going to expect people to be a little bit too pressed and too quick, so we won't have the
time
we had. That's why you see a lot of relationships not making it, because the moment something goes wrong, they need that information quick. Are you going to be with me forever or not? You know, I don't know. Wait a minute, baby, you carry me too fast. Hold on now, let's relax. How you going to ask me if I'm going to be with you forever? And we just been dating 2 weeks. I need to know right now. You going to be with me forever? Okay, wow. If I got an answer right now, the answer is no. Okay, well, fine then. You know, and you don't let things develop. I think that's what it is. I hear you laughing at me too.
That is interesting. We got the microwaves. We get everything very, very quickly, and it could make people get to the point where I'm not waiting for anything. You better let me know now. I want things to happen very, very, very quickly. And the good point you made, then things don't develop. It's like a cake that you don't leave in the oven long enough. It's not going to be as good as it could have been. So that's
right.
Another good point. And that for our listeners here at Off the Shelf is in reference to John's book Cell, which is City Folk Electronically Living Life: The Secrets We Hide in Our Cell Phones. Our special guest today is John Williams, and he is the author of several books. His first was a children's book, Daddy and Me. His second, we just spoke about, Cell. And then we're also going to talk about what could have been The Saint, The Sinner, and The Attempt. And then his book, The Reunion, talking about how John markets and promotes his book, how he goes about writing his stories. And you can visit him online, John Williams, who is also the host of the radio program Creative Soul at Blog Talk Radio. Please drop in and visit John online. Bookmark his website so you can keep up what he's doing. He's online at www.theauthor.us. It's spelled the way it sounds. And again, that's www.theauthor.us. And so we're going to go back. I want to ask John a question about one of his other books, his third book, The Saint, The Sinner, and The Attempt. It was independently published. I wanted to ask you, why did you choose to independently publish a book after having published two other books?
It seems like they say good things come in threes, but I think they come in pairs, you know, marriage, yin and yang, positive, negative. So it's two reasons for that, too. The first reason was I wanted to learn about the industry and the business. The first book was to see if I can do it. And then when I completed it, I reveled in that success. But I'm one of those people that just keep it pushing. I keep it moving, Jack. You know, tomorrow I might be on Mars. Y'all still on Earth. I keep it pushing. So I wanted to learn about the business and learn how to do it myself in case I had some books that were not going to be accepted socially or had some really, really racy subject matter, which brings me to number two.
Okay.
The reason I self-published it is because I shopped it, and because of the subject matter of the book, everybody was like, you know, I'm not saying it's not a good book. I enjoyed it. I couldn't put it down. But for a first-time author, we are really nervous about releasing this project. It was juicy. I'm talking about it is no holds barred, Zane to the 10th degree in terms of the descriptiveness. It's a book about a guy who, Brooklyn, who seemingly has all the tools needed to land any woman he wants. I mean, he's handsome. I'm not talking about myself.
He's from Brooklyn, you know, New York.
Right. Brooklyn Price is his name. He's handsome. He's tall. He's got a chiseled physique. He's got charisma. He's smooth. You know, he's got a decent job. But for whatever reason, he can never seem to do right by women. He never can find the right one, and he thinks it's them. You know, he goes all over the country. I mean, he dates all kinds of women, young, older, black, white, Asian, Hispanic. I mean, from everywhere. And it seems like every time, you know, he thinks he's got it, it's always some new piece that gets thrown in that makes him think otherwise. And it's very, very sexual, very erotic. It's one of those books that you need to run a bubble bath, you know, get you some candles lit, get you a bottle of wine.
One of Zane's books. To our listeners here at Off the Shelf, it sounds like it's on that, because he writes erotica. Zane does.
I love Zane, because, I mean, I liked how she, as a woman, took a chance when most women weren't, right? They were writing about love and peaches and flower petals and sunlight. She was like, I want him to spank me. I want him to make me bite the sheets. I want to be sore. And she took a chance when nobody else like that would.
Mm-hmm. So the saint, the sinner, and the attempt. Does this guy, do the women call off the relationships generally for the same reasons, and he's just slow to get that? And does he ever find a woman that he can have a relationship with?
Well, it has a unique twist. I don't want to give it away, but it certainly explores different avenues and looks at the relationship from a male perspective. And I think that's why it's been so successful. Women really want to know what men, I mean real men, football men, you know, beer drinking, you know, be out in the street, you know, talking, you know, like getting fights before kind of men. You know, we talk about not males, we talk about men. They want to know what makes us tick and what we want and what we desire and what pushes our buttons in a positive sexual kind of way. And so the book really goes into that, man, and it talks about, you know, everything from just sex in general to emotions and how we feel about certain physical types of women. And I think that it's those things that made the book really kind of fly off the shelf.
And so this guy is a well-rounded guy. Again, and I know you can't give the book away, but are these relationships ending without giving the reason because of something that the women are?
Well, a lot of them do, you know, because love is confusing. You know, nobody have all the answers. I think if we did, we'd be millionaires because we come up with some formula that people can take in their coffee like creamer and fix everything. So a lot of the relationships, there are some times where you don't understand things, but a lot of it is spelled out. You know, each relationship ends for a different reason, and it's clear once you get to the end of the chapter.
Okay. How was self-publishing your third book after having already published two books more the mainstream way? And after you work with a publisher to get the book printed, to get the ISBN and the distributed books for your first two books, then you say, you know what, I want to try publishing a book myself just in case I have to go that avenue in the future. How was self-publishing a book different from more of a mainstream publishing?
Well, with mainstream publishing, they handle a lot of the actual physical parts of getting the book out. They do a lot of stuff for you. You know, they do editing, which was a beast. Oh, my God. I have lost sleep editing books, you know, grammar and style, and I forgot a period. So they do a lot of that for you. Also, They assist heavily with the design of the book, something that's appealing, that could, you know, if you're walking in the bookstore, you'll stop and look at that cover and say, oh, what is that? You know, they do a lot of that. They do a lot of the distribution for you, whereas when you self-publish, you really take on a lot of that yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you turn them pages in and there's some missing or a word messed up, it gets printed that way. If you fail to tie up a story or a scene, it stays that way. And then you don't have people designing the cover. You do that yourself. You take your own photographs or find them. You market the book yourself. So it's like it's a trade-off. You know, on one hand, you get to price the book at exactly what you think it's worth. You get a little bit more on the self-publishing side in terms of the revenue. You know, each book that you sell, you might make $6-7 versus $2 or $3 when the publisher does it. So it just depends on what your preference is. But one, you know, it's a headache in a lot of respects either way. But if I had to choose, unless it's a story that I know is mainstream that's going to do very well, I would like to self-publish it just so I can keep the rights to it and have some creative control over what I want to leave in and take out.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I got to tell you, a few years ago, and I don't know if self-publishing, I sometimes think that the African-American authors kind of had a lot to do with pushing that forward. Trying to get books published through the mainstream publisher, being constantly told that African-Americans in large numbers or in large enough numbers didn't really buy books, which wasn't the case. But so then a lot of authors that I knew of started self-publishing their own books, and they really started marketing their books. The internet had a big impact on that because they could put up a website. They could send out free copies of maybe some excerpts of their books. They started going and talking, maybe doing seminars, doing bookstore signings, and also really going out to bookstores directly to keep saying, pick up my book, pick up my book. Karen Quintos Miller, who wrote Satin Doll, I know that's what she did in Philadelphia. She said she put everything into Satin Doll, and she would go to the bookstores. No, they say they weren't going to carry books. She said, y'all going to see me again, and she just kept coming back till finally they started carrying her books. Her book took off, and then they started calling her, saying, can we get some copies of your book for our store? So either way, I've heard authors say, whether you go through a mainstream publisher or you self-publish, you've got to market the book yourself. And a lot of people say that you pretty much have to do a lot of editing yourself. Publishers aren't doing as much of it as they used to. So you're going to have to put in a lot of grind work either way as an author. And if you believe in your books and that you're passionate about it and that's what you want, then I think that an author would go and do that. For a new writer, you'd already published two books, though, John, before you took on the self-publishing with The Sink, The Center, and The Attempt. Would you recommend that a writer who has no experience with the publishing industry, that they start out by self-publishing a book?
Well, in most cases, I would say yes, because it takes a real thick skin to get all the rejections that you get when you shop the book for mainstream. You know, I would say before I got a publishing deal, I sent maybe, 350 query letters.
Wow.
Maybe 500 copies out to different places, you know, excerpts, And again, what was ironic is none of them ever said, oh, this is just terrible. We're not taking this. You know, none of them said that. All of them said, you know, this is amazing work. But, you know, the industry, much like the music business, is going through kind of a weird spot right now. Unless you are a notable name, you know, Eric Jerome, Dickey, Zane, just a number of, even some of the other writers, you know, Elaine Harris, Sandra Brown. I mean, it's unless you have that kind of base already where people are looking for your next book, Sister Soldier, you know, Toni Morrison, unless you're that, they're not really willing to take a financial risk on your work.
I think that when you said financial risk, that you said a very good point, because the publisher has to put out money to print the books, which if you're printing in volume, that can come into thousands of dollars. And then they've got to – the book distributor gets about 50-55% off the bat, and then you know, whatever the bookstore gets. So the publisher really doesn't get 100% off of that retail price. They're going to probably themselves only get maybe 50% of that. Then they've got to carve that out to pay their marketing team and their this team and their that team, and then they've got to pay the author as well. So they want somebody who they know can generate a lot of income. But Zane and Elin Harris actually did get started with self-publishing, and Zane, she started on the internet just putting up free excerpts of her books, and it caught on, and that's how she got started. But so some authors who've gone on to do well, Elin Harris, and he reached out to Essence Magazine to take out an ad in the magazine, and they advised him to. They said that would work, and then he also went to beauty salons. And his books just took off from there. His books just took off. I want to ask you next, what are some comments that readers are sharing with you about The Saint, The Sinner, and The Attempt? What are you hearing from readers about the book?
Well, I mean, I'm on my website. I like to publish all of the reviews, as many of them as I can. And I'll just go there to let you hear, you know, what people are saying, you know. Here's one from you know, a book club, APU, A Place of Our Own. They're one of the major book clubs that does reviews. You know, they gave it 4 stars, saying that, you know, it was one of those things where they never could guess what was going to happen. Your book was absolutely amazing. You know, there's no comparison. I loved every chapter. The childhood love expressed between some of the characters, it's just, you know, and then even to the end where it just was a culmination and a surprise twist, they just were shocked, like, you know, this is a great debut from you, John, and they want me to keep the work coming. 4.5 stars, another book club reviewer, Sydney from Reading Rendezvous, she wrote, you know, this is the first art novel that I've read by John Williams. He's made my author's list. I'm buying anything else that he releases.
Okay.
So I'm getting some good feedback. Also, things that were missed signals. You know, some people, you know, they said it was a hot summer read, but, you know, they wouldn't recommend that to anybody unless they like drama, overly powerful stories, and then the power of love and those who need to be introduced or reminded of a place where love exists. So it's been kind of mostly positive, but I also like putting the stuff that, you know, that maybe ain't so, you know, 2-star, 1-star reviews, because all those things contribute to people looking at the book too. They want to say, I don't agree with that. Let's see if he really did that. Let's see if it's as nasty as we say it is. So all of it, is good and bad, has helped with sales and getting support.
Yeah, and then also, as you learn when you go through and write your next book, since we're going to talk about your fourth book, and then I want to touch on something else further into the interview. But I know the lady who, A Place of Our Own, I think she resides in, I think, if I'm remembering the correct person, in, I want to say Yasmin Coleman in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but I could be wrong. In 2008, you published and A Place of Our Own, just to go on to tell our off-the-shelf listeners. That's a good book review site. So those book reviews aren't like watery book reviews. Hearing the comments from A Place of Our Own, I know, because I know the organization, it really is a good compliment. In 2008, you published your first book under a major publisher. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And the title of that book, which is your fourth, is The Reunion. Can you tell our listeners off the shelf, without giving the book away, what is The Reunion about?
Oh, The Reunion. That one is probably the most complete novel that I've written, and I'll say that because the other books really, they had premises and they had ideas that I took and expounded upon, but this is the first one that could actually be adapted into a screenplay or made into a movie or a stage play. You know, it focuses on a gentleman, Sean Giles, who was really popular in high school. He had a really gifted writing ability, a lot of common sense, great friendships. I drew upon some of my childhood friendships to make him the kind of guy that it's kind of hard not to like him, you know. After graduating, he moved to Dallas, Texas, where I am now, and he attends college and gets his degree, and he pursues his dream of writing and directing stage plays. You know, when he's in college, he meets a very sexy graduate student with a lot of attitude. Her name is Eva Sparks. Oh, my God, that woman.
I can tell by the way you said her name.
Yeah, Eva Sparks. They hit it off right away. Things start out fantastic, but then, you know, real soon, just like in many relationships, you realize you may have bit off more than you can chew.
Yeah.
She a little more than he can handle. I mean, she's got some real problems that he has nothing to do with. You know, she's insecure. She's controlling, jealous, insanely jealous, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
Just a hot mess. I mean, we all know somebody like that.
Mm.
On the surface, they look like they together, but they not. She's actually a far cry from his high school sweetheart and his love of his life more than a decade ago. So it's like he had this high school sweetheart and didn't really work out.
Mm.
So I said all that to say, you know, now he's a graduate. He has received $100,000 so he can produce his first major stage play. So it's kind of like his dreams have been realized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's kind of nervous about it, but this is what he wants. But between that and just his problems with his girlfriend, things couldn't be more crazy in his life. But at the height of his dilemma, at the worst possible time, he receives one of the best things ever. He gets an invitation so he can go back home to Chicago and attend his 10-year high school class reunion.
Okay.
So you know how that is, going back to see all those people you hung out with. And
sweetheart and the whole drill,
yeah,
the whole drama, and the jealous girlfriend. And okay.
Oh, yeah. So he got his pocket full of cash. What he doesn't realize is that Eva is
real close to Evel.
Yeah,
is that why you picked
like,
that name, Eva?
Sean says he's going to go, and he knows his life is real chaotic, but he's going to go because he needs that break, a vacation from that, and his Eva couldn't have come at a better time. But his girlfriend, Eva, she is not for this. She thinks, why he got to go anywhere? He needs to stay home and keep his ass at home. And when he leaves, that woman goes into one of the most frenzied fits of jealousy ever captured on paper. I mean, this woman, this is like poison ivy. Oh, God, it's definitely a book that won't disappoint. It's one of those things that it has a complete story that happens in a short amount of time. So it follows him on this extravagant weekend where he goes back home, and she follows him, and you get to see all the antics and things that happen as a result of her jealousy.
Wow. Oh, my God. And now that does sound exciting, the way you are explaining it and describing a book. It sounds, in the two characters, that's what makes a good story, I think. You got a lot of contrast. There's either a situation that creates a lot of contrast where somebody's struggling against a situation or an environment, or you have two people who there's so much contrast there that it keeps the reader hooked, wondering what's going to happen next. I was going to ask you, who are the characters in the book that readers simply couldn't forget, but it's the guy,
yep.
and it's Miss Eva. It sounds like
the two characters Eva,
that readers just cannot forget. These two people.
Eva Sparks jumps off the page, and I didn't intend it to be that way. I wanted to make the book about Sean and his turmoil and what he goes through. But when I found this character, and we all know her, I've dated her before. This woman is just, oh, my God, just a hot mess, just worrisome, you know what I'm saying, worrisome. And she wanted out, and she just really, everything that she did, it was very easy for me to do that contrast because, you know, Sean is kind of a stand-up guy. You know, he's, you know, everybody trusts him, they like him. And it's like, how could you be with somebody like this? Well, I mean, man is man. You know, she's sexy. She's that compliment. So it's a really interesting story.
Okay, for our listeners, because we only have like 10 minutes left, and I still have so much I wanted to cover with you, for our listeners who want to gain a publisher, if you could just tell them, what are some advice you would give them to go about finding and landing a book publisher? I know you said you had sent out at one point like 350 queries to publishers. What advice would you give somebody to how they can land a publisher?
The biggest advice I'll give is three things. One, you have to be like extremely excited about your work. When you talk about it, it ought to brew up emotions. You ought to smile, get animated. If your story that you came up with, if your work does not do that, you need to go back to the drawing board. Nobody's going to be as excited about your work than you.
Right.
So
I agree.
That's a big thing. The other thing is, you know, realize that the literary world you know, you have to be a complete writer, and it's an infinite learning process. Nobody wants you to come to them and say, oh, I got this idea about this book, right, and we're going to have this man, right? You know, they don't want to see that. They want to see a complete work or as close to complete as possible. They want to have a manuscript that you can present to them that they can read, and you don't have to interject or explain nothing. They can just read the pages and then understand where you were trying to go. If you don't have that, that's where most writers, in my opinion, fail. Because they have this great idea, but they haven't put anything into motion. You know, my mama used to say, you know, I used to say, Mama, it'd be real nice if we had some steak and some lobster. And she's like, that's great. Go get the groceries. Like, I don't want to get the groceries. Well, then you don't want no steak and no lobster then.
Yeah.
And so it's like one of them things. You have to have the work done. And then finally, you have to be diligent and understand that things do take time. You know, it takes time to make a book. It takes time to edit it. It takes time to market it. It takes time for it to even catch on. My first book, Daddy and Me, didn't catch on right away. But then the following year, around Father's Day, they did a special about it, and it just took off. So it took a whole like year just for people to catch on to it.
Wow, that's something. And you seem to in doing research for this interview, you seem to publish a book about once every 1.5 to 2 years, which I think is good. Is that a goal of yours, or are you just naturally putting out a book about once every 1.5 to 2 years?
You know, I never really gave it much thought. I do try to at least have an idea for a different project every year. But this year I have three projects that I'm working on.
Wow.
So I'll give people a sneak peek. You know, the reunion did so well. It had such a shocking ending that people begged me to get back in the lab, put pen to paper, and put out a sequel. So I'm working on a sequel. It'll probably be out at the beginning of 2011. It's going to be called Unbelievable. And
okay.
I don't know if you ever looked at that word, but it actually has embedded in the word the name Eva. So Eva took the cake last book, so we're going to keep her in it.
Okay.
But what I'm putting all my efforts in to try to get out by September is this new project called Pink, P-I-N-K.
Okay.
It's about it's going to be a twofold project where you're going to have a book, but I'm also shooting a film for it. I'm shooting a movie short. It's going to be about 40 minutes, and it's going to come as a supplement to the book. So everybody who buys the book, they're going to also get this movie. And I'm not even talking about some home video. I'm talking about from a production company. I've already lined up who's going to shoot it. I'm doing casting, and I've already got the script completed. And the script is going to be kind of a prequel to what happens in the book. So you'll watch the movie first, get an idea of what's going on, and then you'll read the book and find out how everything turns out. So that one is cool.
Okay, and you said you're working on another project too, right?
Yeah, the third project is going to be my first anthology. You know, I was talking to some major publishers, and they were like, you know, if you believe in work like this, you need to solicit other people and give them a chance. And the best way to do that is to come up with an anthology, kind of like how Zane did with things like, you know, the EroticaNoir.com anthology, where you got a bunch of writers from all walks of life contributing a short story, and the best ones make it, and then you put it all into a book. And so you got a book full of short stories from different writers, and then you put it out under a pseudonym, or you have a theme. So I'm working on that, and I'm actually looking for authors to contribute to that in the late part of 2010. So a lot going on.
You are a busy man with just like 6 more minutes to go. I want to talk about your radio show. I mean, as if it's not enough for our off-the-shelf listeners that John is the publisher of 4 books, which are Daddy and Me, which is a children's book, Sale, City Folk Electronically Living Life, The Secrets We Hide in Our Cell Phones, his third book, What Could Have Been, The Saint, The Sinner, and The Attempt, and his fourth book, The Reunion, which was picked up by a major publisher, so kudos to him. And he's working on a sequel to The Reunion, which he hopes to have out in early 2011, an anthology, and another book that he's going to put out, a short film about 40 minutes with. You can visit John Williams, who's the author of these books, online at www.theauthor.us. What I want to talk with John about before, we just got a few more minutes left, is his radio show, Creative Corner. When did it, Creative Corner, is it Creative Corner or Creative Soul?
It's Creative Soul. Creative Corner is where I feature a creative artist. You know, the idea came up just from not having a presence on radio to feature some artists that were on the verge. You know, it caters to, you know, artist types of all walks, you know, poets, photographers, you know, musicians, professionals, athletes. Each week on Saturdays from 12 to 2, I interview and have discussion topics where we discuss all things creative. You know, I've had some pretty, some notables on the show. A lot of, you know, PJ Morton. I've had some folks who are on I Want to Work for Diddy show, trying to get some of the Atlanta Housewives. Basically, anything you do creative, people want to find out about it. You know, I actually interviewed a rocket scientist because I always wanted to know what they did. You know, so we had an hour where we talked about that. I got the show coming up in a little bit where I'm going to interview a spoken word artist and Alpha Phi Alpha member, so we can talk about that. So every week you come on, and it just gives an outlet for people that's like-minded like me.
And it comes on from 12 to 2, what, at not Eastern Standard Time, but Pacific?
Central. Central.
Oh, Central Standard
Time.
Okay, Central Standard Time for our listeners here at Off the Shelf. It is on Blog Talk Radio, so you can look up Creative Soul with John Williams, and it's from 12 to 2 Central Standard Time on Saturdays. How can somebody who's interested in appearing on Creative Soul, what should they do to contact you to be scheduled to be interviewed on the show?
Well, the best way is to visit the website. If you go to www.theauthor.us, there's a page where you can submit a form. Basically, if you ain't crazy and threatening nobody and what you do is truly creative, you can be on the show. I'll actually call you myself and talk a little bit about what you're doing. We'll pick some dates and pencil you in, and as long as you show up, we good. I've had people who, you know, more recently, a lot of musicians have reached out to me that may not be in mainstream media, and I've been having a lot of success there, a lot of authors, and then some professionals that maybe have businesses that are different, like bars and, you know, restaurants and clubs. All that stuff it all contributes to us in form of arts.
Okay. I wanted to ask you next, are you going to be appearing at, we know you're working on 3 projects, are you going to be appearing at any upcoming events or book signings? And if so, could you let us know so our off-the-shelf listeners can come out and support you?
Yeah, this summer is going to be huge for me. Next week I'm going to be in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm going to be doing some, I wouldn't say pro bono, but basically some events using the library system. I'll be doing stuff there next week. And then in April, I'm going to be in Dallas and the surrounding suburbs doing stuff at their library system. You can always find me at any major book event, any expo. I'm trying to find the one to get my publicist to help me out and do the one in Houston that's coming up. And then I want to do the one on the East Coast that y'all have in the Baltimore area. The best way to keep up with me, though, is the website, because right now I'm focused on doing the work, and the events and stuff kind of come second nature. But on any given day, you can find me at any neo-soul bar. You can find me anywhere that got good soul food. And I usually try to keep Facebook updated with what I'm going to be doing next. So in case you just want to, you know, come sit and have a round with me or talk, you can know where to find me.
Now, where would our listeners go at your website to find out the events that you're coming under? Is it under a certain section? I forget. I know I've been to your website. Is it something that says events, or where would they go?
Yeah, if they take a look at the news section or any booking section, you'll be able to get that information. One of the big things I'm doing now is getting a P.O. box so I can start taking those letters like Zane. So I'm going to have a big push to get fans and readers to send me their comments and questions and, you know, inquiries. But check the website. I always update it. I'm on that thing like every day.
Okay. So that's good. That keeps you that's a good way to get high rankings in the search engines by constantly updating your website. We just have about 60 seconds left. I just want to take this time to thank John again. He's been so gracious, and I really appreciate you being here on Off the Shelf. You can't know enough, particularly since I missed your show on the end of January. So I thank you again and for being so gracious. I encourage our listeners to check out John's books. He's the author of 4 books, Daddy and Me, Sell, What Could Have Been, The Saint, The Sinner, and The Attempt, and The Reunion. He's online at www.theauthor.us. He's going to be appearing at a different events upcoming, as he stated. You can check out his website to keep up with him. And he's working on 3 new projects you can look forward to seeing in the near future. To all of our listeners and to John, thank you for being here with us this morning on Off the Shelf. I encourage you, please stop in and visit me online at chistel.com. Come back next Saturday at 11. We'll continue to bring you movers and shakers in the literary and book and entertainment industry. Remember that you are so valued, so truly blessed, and have a blessed day. And bye for now. John, I'll shoot you email.